It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Could a psychedelic drug save your life?
I have a mood disorder, and my medications had stopped working. I was in a profoundly broken, devastated place. And then somebody said to me, I heard this story from a friend about a doctor, and he's been microdosing for decades, and maybe he has some extra. And I thought, it just sounds nuts.
Writer Ayelet Waldman.
About a week or two later, I opened my mailbox and there was this package, and the return address read Lewis Carroll. So I opened the package, there was this little blue bottle. And I looked at it, and I'm not crazy. I don't take things that come in the mail. I went and I ordered an LSD testing kit from Amazon. Yes, that's where you get them. It turned out to be LSD diluted in distilled water. And so I thought, all right, I'm just going to trust this. I put two drops under my tongue. I waited for, you know, my keyboard to burst into psychedelic fireworks.
Goodness knows what this was.
That didn't happen. But what did happen is that I had a really good day. The first in as long as I could remember. It was like this dark, heavy weight just lifted off my shoulders. When I would ask, like, the most sort of stonery people, like, if they could get me some LSD, they would always say, when you're ready for the mother, she will come to you. And I would, like, roll my eyes and move on. And when I tell people this story, they're like, well, the mother came to you because you were ready.
Ayelet Waldman tried microdosing with LSD for 1 month. Her experiment is over. She's not planning on breaking the law again. But she says that 1 month made a huge difference in her mood, her marriage, and her life. And if you knew it was safe, and if it would help you, would you take the same trip? Here's Ayelet again.
I know it sounds crazy, and I've never taken LSD. I was not one of those people in college who did that kind of thing. I mean, the last thing I wanted to do is get into the dark places in my own brain. I'm scared enough about the light places in my own brain. But I taught for about 7 years at the University of California. I was an adjunct professor in the law school, and I taught a class called The Legal and Social Implications of the War on Drugs. And I had come across this book by a psychedelic researcher from back in the 60s named James Fadiman, who described using LSD in tiny doses, microdoses, which is effectively a tenth of a dose. And what Fadiman described was, he said that when someone took a microdose of LSD, they didn't hallucinate, they didn't have a trip. They just, at the end of the day, they would look back on their day and say, huh, that was a really good day.
So this is not a melt your mind, see the world in six dimensions kind of dose.
No. I can barely handle the dimensions we have. You know, I am not a melt your mind kind of girl.
Did you tell anybody you were thinking about this during this time? I mean, did you got four kids and a husband. Did you talk with any of them about this?
I told my husband for sure. And my husband has had, unlike me, my husband had experience with, you know, big on regular doses of LSD, a fair number of them. And he was so, it hurt, you know, it hurt him so much to see me in such pain. And it also affected him. And he said, you know, go for it. Give it a shot. It's not going to hurt you, sweetie. And maybe it'll help. I wasn't so confident that it wasn't going to hurt me. So before I could do it, I did a lot of research. But I didn't tell my kids. I mean, you know, like, mommy's going to try some acid, honey. What do you think? I mean, that wasn't going to work. But eventually I had to tell them, right? Because the experiment was such a success, I decided to write about it. And then I had to tell them.
Well, it's also worth pointing out that you, before you became a full-time writer, you were a federal public defender. So you presumably had plenty of experience with repercussions of using illegal drugs.
I did. And that gave me a lot of pause. You know, I've seen people go to jail for a long time for offenses that would seem to the layperson to be very, very minor. I've seen the viciousness with which this country fights its war on drugs. the real tragedy is that, you know, this I come at this place from a really intensely privileged place. If I were a young African-American man without resources in Detroit with an aggressive police presence, I couldn't take this risk. I could end up in jail. So, I mean, that's one of the reasons I've been so public about it, because I feel like with privilege comes responsibility. And you have to speak for those who don't, whose lack of privilege makes speaking more dangerous.
You took LSD, these microdoses, for a month. That's all you had.
Yeah.
It was a month's worth of the stuff. How did the experience change, or did it, over the course of the month?
Well, the protocol is not every day. You take it every fourth day. The third day of each cycle, when I was just me, I definitely was like, oh, yeah, well, there you are.
So you could feel a difference that fast.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah,
could you feel
totally.
It kick in?
Yeah, that day. I would, like, make breakfast and, like, drive carpool and do my normal mom stuff. And about 90 minutes later, after I took it, I remember once looking out my window and my dogwood tree was in bloom and thinking, oh, look how beautiful that is.
And that's unusual for you?
Unusual for me. Maybe typical for most people, but for me, that was a really lovely moment because I could appreciate the natural beauty. I could appreciate lots of things. Or I might like take an extra minute to like cuddle with the dog because she was being so cute, that kind of thing. And then I'd get to work. And then I would work. Like, I mean, I wrote better in that month than I have than the only other time that I can that was better, but it was scarier, was when I wrote, you know, two books in a month because I was in a hypomanic period.
Wow.
And that's awesome, but that's dangerous.
Yeah. You wrote in the book that you feel like microdosing with LSD saved your marriage.
I feel like it did. You know, I don't know what my husband would say.
Well, actually, I do.
You do.
Hold on. Well, your husband, Michael Chabon, is also a writer, and he was in the studio with us just a couple of weeks ago, and so we asked him.
Okay.
So here, I'm just going to play. Here's your husband answering the question, do you think microdosing saved your marriage?
Well, I mean, with all due respect to my beloved wife, I think, you know, I mean, let's put it this way. It's part of her mood disorder to think that, in a sense, that to believe that things are that dire or were that dire was a part of the illness itself. So in that regard, I can't argue with that. I mean, that's how it felt, and it was that sense of urgency that led her to take this pretty radical step of trying to investigate this particular solution.
And then he goes on, he really loves you.
I'm sorry, but I'm a little teary now. He's an amazing man. You know, he's had to deal with a lot. He's had to deal with a lot, and he's dealt with it with such generosity and grace. Sorry.
Well, I think it sounds like he's there for the long haul no matter what. So from his perspective, it sounds like he wasn't going anywhere.
Yeah.
Why did you think things were so bad?
I think when you're depressed, you hate yourself so much you can't imagine that you're lovable. Part of my depression is such an intense self-loathing that how could anyone love me, especially someone who I love and admire and almost revere in a way? How could he love me when I am so very unlovable? But I actually think that he's right. I think that is the mental illness talking. And I'm actually kind of a great wife. You know, I am ferocious and devoted and loyal. And, you know, Michael's a really easygoing guy. He doesn't say leap to his own defense ever. He's easygoing. But it's nice to be easygoing if you know that, like, there's a chained pit bull in your backyard that you could just spring the lock and, like, woof, they're going to come out, right? So, and also, you know, we laugh at the same jokes and watch this and enjoy the same TV shows and sometimes read the same books and think the same things are funny. And it is a really strong marriage. It's had its low points.
Well,
Heaven knows.
I was going to say, you did this microdosing thing for a month, and it had this amazing effect on you. And then it's an illegal drug. It ran out. You don't want to risk, you know, your life and welfare and families by ordering any more. Where does that leave you? I mean, do you feel like it had any permanent effect on you?
You know, I think that the dramatic nature of the improvement had a permanent effect. I mean, one of the features of depression is when you're depressed, you feel like you've always been depressed and you're mm-hmm. always going to be depressed and you see no positive possibility. And the fact that I felt so much better so quickly and that it sustained for that month and a little bit after, that really has given me a kind of perspective ever since. I have not dropped again, which is not to say that I won't. It is possible that I will sink again to that dark place. And if I do, and please don't tell Jeff Sessions, if I sink again to that dark place and I am confronted with the choice between killing myself or committing a crime that will make me feel better, I'll try everything else first. You know, there's great research now with ketamine infusions. There's psilocybin studies that maybe I could get access to. But if I can't do anything else, you know, I'd rather my children have a mother who committed a crime than have no mother at all. But there's no doubt in my mind that if this becomes a legally viable alternative to SSRIs or mood stabilizers, I will be the first person in line to get my prescription.
Ayala Waldman. She wrote about her experience microdosing with LSD in a book called A Really Good Day. So Ayala did a lot of reading before she tried taking those LSD microdoses. And she tracked down a bunch of old research studies done decades ago, back before the government criminalized LSD. This is a cautionary tale about how public policy, formulated for political reasons, can make scientific knowledge disappear. For decades.
I'm Dr. Stephen Ross, NYU School of Medicine, Bellevue Hospital. I'm an addiction psychiatrist. In 2006, I was being supervised by a colleague, Jeffrey Gus, and there was a 50th anniversary of the discovery of LSD. And I said to him, why would anyone commemorate that? And he said to me, well, it was actually part of psychiatry for a long time. I'd never heard about any of that in my medical training or psychiatric training. So I started to look at the old literature, and what I found astounded me. You know, hidden in plain sight, psychedelics had been a big part of psychiatry for close to a quarter of a century, over 1,000 studies, tens of thousands of research participants, and the Controlled Substance Act, putting all of these substances into Schedule I, Nixon declaring war on drugs, was so effectively suppressed them that they were erased from the education of people in medicine and psychiatry and psychology. And I just couldn't believe that all this interesting research had happened and I never knew about it.
That was then. Today, Stephen Ross runs a lab at NYU, and it's one of a handful that has won approval from the FDA and the DEA to go back to investigating the therapeutic benefits of psychedelic drugs. He told Steve Paulson what they found.
Well, by far the most promising indication is the use of psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy to treat cancer-related anxiety and depression, including fear of death. Our group and the Johns Hopkins group recently published on December 1st the largest and best controlled trials of using a psychedelic agent with psychotherapy to treat cancer-related distress. And what we both found was very interesting, that a single dose of psilocybin versus placebo led to immediate and very large-scale reductions in anxiety and depression. 80% of our participants went into immediate remission from their depressive symptoms, and this endured over many months. And we found that psilocybin induced these unusual mystical-type experiences that have been described in the psychology of religion, have been validated by Johns Hopkins. And we found 70% of our participants said this was the singular top five most meaningful experience of their lives.
But, I mean, the fact that this profound change can happen from a single dose, that's kind of staggering, I have to say.
Well, I really had a hard time believing it at first. And we kept having patients. A typical patient was a woman in her mid-50s who had metastatic gynecologic cancer and who was dying. And they would say, by the end of the day, I feel dramatically better. My depression is gone. My anxiety is gone. I'm not worried about the dying process. Some patients saying, you know, the symptoms never came back. And I really was skeptical. I thought, how can this be? This doesn't make any sense. But after doing it close to 30 times, and then we looked at the data, I realized that we really had, you know, it was a profound finding that it could work so rapidly and have such a sustained clinical benefit.
How do you explain that?
I think it goes back to the the nature of the experience. These are patients that have cancer. They come in there, they're primed to have an experience that's related to cancer. The intention for the day is to deal with their cancer-related distress, much different than how these drugs are used recreationally.
So these people are going in with a certain intention, and that's important here. I mean, they want a particular kind of experience to result from taking psilocybin.
Yes, that's key. We spend a lot of time with the participants ahead of time. We get to know the history of their life in great detail. We get to know the history of cancer. You know, they come in and there's a small ritual with the two therapists. We hold hands with them. We ask them to state their intention. And it's a long day. It's 8 hours. Sometimes they sit there the entire time not moving. It looks like they're sleeping. But when they get up, they start to tell these very interesting tales of where they've been. And a little bit like a waking dream, but the themes center around cancer, death, distress, you know, seeing themselves die, having death experiences, getting new bodies, you know, that weren't cancer riddled, and all kinds of interesting things.
So this is not just euphoria. It sounds like some of this is pretty difficult. There might be an element of the bad trip here.
Yes. Just about everyone had some other difficult things come up. Typically, they would pass through it and then reach a sense of sort of being at peace or serenity or powerful intuitive insights that they came through the difficult parts better off.
Hmm. Now, we've been talking about the use of psilocybin for end-of-life anxiety. They seem to be effective for addiction as well. What are you finding there?
Well, that's really what got me so excited about this field. I'm an addiction psychiatrist, and I thought, wow, these are such interesting tools. And they made sense to me because an addiction can be understood as this kind of spiritual malady of sorts, and we have 12-step and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I even came to learn the story of Bill Wilson that I'd never heard before, that he got sober in 1934 from a drug-induced psychedelic experience with belladonna alkaloid.
Really? I didn't know that. Huh.
Yeah, he was a hopeless alcoholic here in Manhattan, and his doctor, William Silkworth, recommended this new treatment, this belladonna alkaloid, which blocks this acetylcholine receptor and can make people delirious, psychotic, and I guess have mystical experiences. And he had this white light of that he experiences God penetrating from outside to, you know, his hospital room. He had a mystical vision of alcoholics forming a chain to each other. That was his vision of the mutual self-help part of it.
So what are you finding then about when people come into your lab, you know, suffering from alcoholism? How effective is this?
Well, Michael Bogenschutz, who we recruited from New Mexico, he did a pilot trial there, open label in 10 participants with alcoholism. And what he found is that psilocybin mixed with this type of psychotherapy, motivational interviewing, led to these dramatic reductions in drinking outcomes. So he and I used that data and designed a controlled trial, which we're doing now at NYU. We're about a third of the way done. We haven't broken the blind, so we don't know. But Johns Hopkins is also doing psilocybin research. Matt Johnson is leading a trial there of using psilocybin to treat tobacco addiction. And his pilot trial is also astounding. He treated 10 people. At 6 months follow-up, 80% were completely sober, which was biologically verified. So as an addiction physician, I'm really excited. I also want to try psychedelics to treat opiate addiction. We have a huge public health problem going on with opiates, and we're studying them for alcohol, but I'd love to design a trial to help opiate addicts.
Are basically all the same things at play here in the brain? I mean, is it, whether we're talking about addiction or depression or end-of-life anxiety, presumably this stuff, I mean, psilocybin is producing a particular effect on the brain.
There's a very appealing model put forth by Robin Carhart-Harris of the Imperial Group in London, and what he found was very interesting. He found through fMRI that psilocybin deactivated a part of the brain called the default mode network. The default mode network is a part of the brain that when we're reflecting on who we are, thinking about the future, or when our brain is just sort of resting, a lot of energy is being consumed. And some think that it's the kind of biological basis of the ego. And the default mode network is hyperactive in diseases like depression and addiction.
You can sort of get locked into a negative loop. I mean, you keep thinking these bad thoughts and it just sort of repeats over and over again.
Exactly. Or the cancer patient, I'm stuck here, my life's over, I'll never get out of this. Or the addict, I'm giving up, I just have this relationship with the drug, I'm always going to be a slave to it. And what psychedelics do is they deactivate the default mode network. It's possible that they kind of get you out of this constrained, repetitive, obsessional loop. But we don't think that it's curative. We think that it kind of opens a door to a different way of thinking, feeling, perceiving, but that you really then need to work with the patient in psychotherapy to facilitate that process. That's our model at NYU.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a huge question here, which is, I mean, obviously something powerful is happening in the brain, but is it sort of just this one-time experience that causes this huge psychological and emotional experience, this overwhelming experience that then people take back? Or is something actually changing in the brain after that single dose of psilocybin? I mean, is the brain getting rewired?
Well, I think it's all the same. When you have a big experience that's highly instructive, it creates profound memory pathways. So whatever is happening, there is definitely something happening in the brain. The psychological experience is there's a neural underpinning to it. And what those changes are and how they're different and how they actually make people better is we got to dig deeper. There's something really interesting there, but we don't fully understand it yet.
I have to say, it all sounds a little like magic. I mean, you take one pill in the proper setting, you know, with the right clinical people there to look out for you, and potentially a lifetime of anxiety disappears.
Well, I tend to shy away from hyperbole and magic and cure. I worry people would think that this is going to be some magic cure. And in particular, I worry that people in the lay public will go out and try to find mushrooms. That's when people get into trouble with psychedelics, because you don't know what you're getting. It's illegal. You don't have any licensed clinicians that can give this to you. And it's just a crapshoot. But it's heartbreaking. So many distressed people. Nothing has worked. Please help me. I need help now. And we say, we'll put you on a list. So it's very difficult.
Yeah. So what's the future for psychedelics, particularly in terms of these possible therapeutic treatments?
Well, I think psychiatry is going to look a lot different in 5 to 10 years. And the three main models, and there's many more, but the three main models, and these are three trials that are going to be happening in my laboratory at NYU. One is the use of ketamine for depression. And ketamine is a big breakthrough in psychopharmacology, the first agent in 50 years that works rapidly. And ketamine is a psychedelic drug. Then you have psilocybin for cancer and depression. And then you have MDMA for PTSD. I think these are the three paradigms that are the future of psychiatry. They're so radically different, and they're, you know, going after very difficult to treat disorders that with psychopharmacology we haven't done a great job doing. I can't tell you how many students and psychiatric residents are so excited that this is the dawn of a new field. You know, and it's not like, you know, 10, 20 years away. The research is mature. It's been going on now, building for 2 decades around psilocybin and MDMA. So it's an interesting and exciting time.
Stephen Ross. He's an addiction psychiatrist at NYU's School of Medicine and Bellevue Hospital, and he was talking with Steve Paulson. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI. Public Radio International. If psychedelic therapy takes off, a lot of people could wind up having a profound hallucinogenic experience in a hospital or doctor's office. What exactly would that be like? Well, Catherine McLean used to work as a guide for Johns Hopkins psychedelic research studies, so she was the one who sat with patients and helped them move through a trip. Now she runs the Psychedelic Education and Continuing Care Program. And she recently sat down with Charles Monroe Kane to talk about what she's learned in the clinical setting. and also out on the street.
You know, it's an interesting term, this idea of a psychedelic guide, and lots of people have issues with it because they think that you are kind of guiding them into a particular experience. And so I've started to give people another way of thinking about what a guide is. You know, when I traveled to really high Himalayan peaks in Nepal, I hired a guide. You know, I didn't hire someone to walk with me like a walker. I wanted someone who really knew the territory. And of course, they can't get you over the mountain, but they can surely get you through some really difficult terrain. And I think about psychedelic guiding in the same way, that you, it's more than just walking next to them as they go through their most difficult and intimate life experiences. You know the territory. You can bring all of your past experience to bear as they are going through something that is new and mysterious and hopefully really illuminating for them.
Okay, so there I am. I'm in the room with you. It's a cool space. It's probably, you know, dim lights. I got headphones on. I got eye shades. And something comes up, and I start tripping really hard, and it gets really, really hardcore, and I freak out. What do you do? I say, do you put your hand on their shoulder and say it's going to be okay? And this person's seeing some crazy stuff at that moment.
What I basically would do is ensure that they were physically safe. And yeah. I would often say, you know, your body is safe. I'm here with you. One of the mantras that I was taught was called in and through. And so you're not trying to distract someone from the pain or the fear or the really intense, you know, sometimes they're really frank hallucinations where it's hard to tell what's real. Right. You're not trying to distract them. You're not trying to guide them out of it. You're actually really encouraging them to be as fully in the experience as possible. You know, in the back of their mind, they've spent a month getting to know you in different preparatory sessions. And so I always kind of planted a little seed with each person I worked with. And I said, there may be times in that room on the session day when you might get paranoid, you might feel like you're dying or going crazy, or the world is, you know, dissolving around you. And there's going to be a part of you that remembers that we had this conversation and that you will know when you hear my voice that you're safe.
You know, it's funny. I hear you talking and I'm thinking to myself, well, I'm sure many of our listeners have taken magic mushrooms, taken LSD. Many of my friends have. I've been to many instances where many people are on it. Rock concerts, out in the woods, messing around with your friends on mushrooms. People do this drug a lot recreationally. And I hear you talk and I'm like, God, did we do it all wrong? Did everybody do it wrong?
No, it's, I mean, we did it. We, you know, to answer from a very, I think, scientific framework, we actually did a survey where people could tell us all about their most spiritual or meaningful psilocybin mushroom experience. Mm-hmm. And in terms of spiritual transcendent, you know, unity experiences that we see at a rate of about 70% in the laboratory with all of the, you know, the guiding, the preparation, the integration afterward, all of the best possible methods. In the survey with recreational use, it was only 30%.
Wow.
But it was still 30%, which means that people are actually pretty good at finding their way into these amazing experiences, even when, you know, 100 million things can go wrong.
Because sometimes in the parking lot at the Grateful Dead concert, things go wrong, you know?
Right.
No, seriously, things go wrong and people freak out. Do you think people should be doing this recreationally? Or you're like, no, you got to have a guide. You got to follow these protocols. What do you think?
Oh, on the one hand, I always say this about the work I did at Hopkins. In most respects, the room, the fact that there were no windows, the fact that we couldn't bring people outside, the fact that they didn't have their friends and loved ones with them, so much about it was kind of paranoia-inducing. You know, you had to give your ID and you give up your shoes. And I think I would freak out in that environment. And yet it worked. The other side of that coin, though, is that I really worry about, you know, making the psychedelic experience medical and sanitized and like the same cookie cutter thing for everybody.
Right.
I guess what I mean about sanitizing the experience is I don't think we should take all of the appearance of risk away. You know, these are inherently risky experiences. Maybe they're medically safe, but people are getting into some pretty wild and intense psychological territory. And I think if you make it too safe, or you tell people, you promise them that it's going to be safe and risk-free just because you have all the trappings of a really well-trained guide and a medical environment, you're taking something away from the person's quest, you know, their journey to go through this on their own.
There's an underground movement who are doing this not in the clinical setting, where they're out doing therapy. You know, they're nurse practitioners, they're doctors, and they're doing psychedelic therapy illegally underground to treat people. What do you think about the underground movement? I mean, because that's potential to destroy a lot of hard work that people are doing, but also is helping people.
Yeah, I think it's filling a need right now that is real. It's saving people's lives. You know, there's a lot of suffering. There are people who are suicidal for any number of reasons, whether it's unremitting, you know, depression or trauma or chronic pain. I mean, people who have cluster headaches who describe them as so bad that they have every reason to live, but they're like, I can't live through another headache like this. And then they take a small amount of psilocybin mushrooms and the headaches go away. And so it's like, who are we to decide for that person that that's not an appropriate decision? I mean, it's their life.
Yeah, I'm curious. You've watched so many people on drugs in these very intense settings. What have you learned about us being humans? I mean, have you learned something about our souls, about our brains? What have you learned about us? Are you happy for us? Are you hopeful for us? How are we doing?
I'm way more hopeful when I am around people on psychedelics than when I'm around sober people. Let's put it that way. This is going to sound potentially very cheesy and new agey or whatever, but I'll just say it. Every single time that I've sat through a session, and this includes, you know, at festivals when I do harm reduction work, and in that case, it's a lot of LSD, you know, totally uncontrolled environment. People show up and we just basically, in the course of a minute or so, have to convince them to trust us and stay there and ride it out. Ultimately, it's like every single person who shows up or every single session I'm in, I come away feeling like we are totally all connected. Hmm. Like every single thing that has ever happened in that person's life to lead them to this point, where all of the things that have happened in my life to lead me to this point, and now here we are having this incredibly intimate, fractal, holographic experience around this drug. And I'm like, wait, I think we all are actually connected. You know, this is what the Buddhists have been trying to say. And then, of course, you know, time goes by and I forget that feeling. And so it's nice to be reminded. I feel like psychedelics probably more than anything else remind us of that.
Catherine McLean runs the Psychedelic Education and Continuing Care Program, and she was talking with Charles Monroe Kane.
My name is Daniel Caza. I was a staff sergeant on the 82nd Airborne. I served from 2003 to 2015. Operation Iraqi Freedom 1, 2, 3, The Surge in its entirety, Operation New Dawn 2, and Operation Unified Response in Haiti. I kind of reached like a plateau of like a healthy balance of, you know, weed, alcohol, talk therapy with a counselor, many other different kinds of therapies, having trouble sleeping, irritability, crap like that, you know, happens to everybody. But when it's happening, when you're getting treatment for PTSD, it's exacerbated because, well, you've got PTSD. My wife, she was kind of getting frustrated with, you know, all of my symptoms, I guess, and telling me that, you know, something needs to change, you got to do something different. And so she was reaching out to her friends, her family, and there was an opportunity to take ayahuasca. I just jumped on it. I don't know. I guess I'm the type of guy that just kind of leaps at it and says, yeah, fucking hey, I'm going to go do that. So I arrived late and kind of washed up from, you know, sleeping in my truck the night before, and, you know, met up with this group of veterans, mostly Marines and the Navy guys, and the setting was kind of critical, I guess. It was on the side of a mountain. I don't know the name of the farm or too much about where I was. I guess it's kind of the ayahuasca talking or whatever, you know, just forgetting where the fuck you were for a bit. We did some guided meditation first, smoked a bunch of pot around the fire. Later on in the afternoon, you know, it was time for some frog poison. So I climbed up the mountain again, and I had never taken any frog poison before. I didn't even know what the puff I was about to take. So the Marine burned some holes in my flesh on my arm and took my knife, grabbed some frog venom, it was like a paste, and just put it on the three holes in my arm, and said, off you go. You know, don't be a big Sophie about it. Just go. You know, I just started tripping balls, man. I don't know. The overwhelming feeling of, like, warmth, every, you know, hair on my body, just feeling the wind rush across it, looking at fucking nature, you know, the kind of shit you do when you're high, man. It was, like, tenfold mega awesome. That's what it felt like. And I decided I was going to walk to the top of the mountain and be close to the sun because it was super warm. And, you know, I sat there and hung out with myself, just taking it in. And, you know, later in the night, it was time for some ayahuasca. you know, we loaded up in some vans. We went to another place. The shaman was another vet, an older vet. And, you know, he discussed what his relationship with ayahuasca is to him, you know, what it means to take part in this kind of ritual. And all of us that, you know, were ayahuasca virgins or whatever, we're just snickering and giggling about, you know, all right, this is where I'm going to blow chunks, just so we're clear. Oh, I took my drink. It tastes like flat Mr. Pibb and prune juice is what we all, as a consensus, decided, like, yeah, that's what that flavor is. That awful, awful taste that you can, that's in your minds right now, is what it tasted like coming back up. But when it came time for that, like, it was just a moment of, all right, my body is frozen in time right now, and I'm stuck here with myself, and, you know, whatever messages, whatever visions I'm supposed to receive, they're coming. And when they did, it was super fast, and I just know, it was like a knowing of, all right, all that just hit me, and now it's time to let this shit out. Like, after letting all that out, it was just a huge weight was, like, lifted off of me, because it feels like you're dying. And it felt good to just clean all that crap out of me, and what seemed like an eternity was probably only a few hours. But, you know, at the end of the night, when everybody had purged and let go of all their dish, you know, we gathered by a fire, and, you know, everybody just felt great. Like, that's what it did for us, because each individual had their own vision, their own moment with the ayahuasca. I wasn't completely healed, but wounds were healed. There's a few pivotal moments, I guess, in my military life on active duty that had a lot of guilt and shame attached to them, but I couldn't quite grasp, like, how I'm supposed to deal with it. And since taking that ayahuasca, you know, I've been able to share that moment and be able to talk with the people that were there with me about it. Like, hey, let's talk about that thing that's bugging me, or you talk about that thing that's bugging you about this particular day, or this, the way this went down, or anything like that. We're survivors. We survived something, and, you know, now we're obligated to live.
Dan Kaza was a staff sergeant in the 82nd Airborne. He served from 2003 to 2015. Since then, he's taken technical college programs in plumbing and bricklaying, and today he works with the Medical College of Wisconsin on veterans' healthcare issues. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI. Public Radio International. We're talking about using psychedelic drugs for therapy. And another word for psychedelic is entheogen, a drug that can deliver an experience of something spiritual. Call it the divine. Call it God. So what is it about the psychedelic experience that makes it sacred?
The very first time I had a psychedelic experience, I was a graduate student at the University of Göttingen in West Germany.
Psychologist Bill Richards.
I knew nothing about psychedelics at the time, but a couple of my friends had participated in an interesting experiment in the psychiatric clinic nearby with some drug that was claimed to give you memories from early childhood. It sounded interesting, and I applied, and they accepted me and gave me an injection of some drug called psilocybin I had never heard of, and essentially left me alone. Not the proper way to conduct psychedelic research, but they didn't know any better. Anyway, I lay back, and my consciousness expanded, opened up to just this exquisitely beautiful panorama of abstract, colorful designs and patterns. As best I can put it into language, it felt like I became the energy flowing through those patterns, and then the consciousness kind of merged with those patterns. And all of a sudden, there was this mystical consciousness, feeling as though I was outside of history, looking back on the world of time with an incredible sense of profundity and beauty and stark reality. So, like, all I could feel really was gratitude and a sense of love and peace beyond what I ever thought was possible.
Bill Richards went on to study theology and then clinical psychology. And today he does research on psychedelics at Johns Hopkins, which makes him one of only a handful of scholars around the world who studied those drugs both back in the 60s and today. Bill told Steve Paulson about that first experience back in 1963 and how it changed his life.
I was awestruck. And of course, looking back, it was a pivotal point in my whole career, you know. I hadn't even heard the word psychedelic at that time. Aldous Huxley had coined it a few months earlier.
And we should point out, this was all legal at that time.
I mean, yes,
you could do research on this, and you didn't have to jump through a whole lot of hoops to get permission.
That's right. Not only was it legal, it wasn't even controversial. You know, I was a graduate student in good physical and mental health, and it was perfectly logical to give me a non-addictive, interesting substance if I would write up a good research report, you know, as part of academia.
You had that amazing, mind-blowing experience, that first experience with psilocybin. Did you have other psilocybin experiences then? Did you try any other drugs, any other psychedelics?
Well, the experimental design of that study was comparing two short-acting derivatives of psilocybin, so I agreed initially to take it four times. Interestingly enough, the next three experiences weren't mystical at all. They were kind of insightful, interesting sensations, but nothing like that first session. Then I had an opportunity to have one more psilocybin session with a higher dose, and that was probably one of the more profound experiences of my life. It was a return to what I had glimpsed in the first session, and it was just a very strong affirmation of the, for want of a better word, the eternal world.
Now, do you think you really had some contact with the divine?
The divine certainly had contact with me. You know, it's hard to put into words because the everyday personality, you know, my Bill Richards, if you will, essentially is transcended or dies or melts when this universal state of consciousness manifests itself.
Now, there have been a lot of twists and turns in the history of research on psychedelics. And back in the 60s, as you've been saying, this research flourished. There were thousands of people who participated in studies of LSD alone. And then it suddenly stopped, right. Especially That's in the right. United States. What happened?
It was just a time of radical cultural change. You know, the feelings about the war in Vietnam, the women's movement. And somehow I think LSD kind of became the icon or the archetype, and Timothy Leary as its main spokesperson.
Well, and Timothy Leary gets a lot of the blame in the way this history is usually written. You know, he was a Harvard professor, lost his professorship because of what was considered irresponsible research, and then he became this prophet of LSD in ways that seemed to not always be safely used.
Precisely. I met Timothy, and I have to say I had some very respectful interactions with him and appreciate that he did try to do some very conventional good research early in his career. You know, he was struggling to live his best. He stumbled onto these profound mystical experiences with no training in theology or religious studies, so he didn't really have the language to communicate with the world of religious scholarship.
Do you need religious training to be able to study these substances? I mean, are you saying that you can't just approach these as a scientist?
Well, you can't experience these states without becoming interested in the realms of religion or spirituality. They're simply blatantly obvious and within us all.
So what separates the mind-blowing experience with lots of fireworks, you know, lots of sort of strong, powerful imagery, but no deeper meaning from what you would call a religious or a sacred experience?
It's important to realize that there is a continuum, a vast variety of so-called psychedelic experiences. And it depends on who the person is, where they are in life, their capacity to trust and be interpersonally grounded. It depends on dosage and purity of the substance. So there's this continuum from mild perceptual changes, kind of giggling and seeing pretty colors. And on that level, it may be interesting to some, scary to others, but it has no real value in terms of personal or spiritual development that I can see. And then, if you will, a little deeper into the psyche, there's the realm of reliving developmental experiences in your childhood of grief and guilt and traumas and kind of deciding who you are and what's important in your life. And then if you go a little deeper, people come to this symbolic archetypal realm of visions of precious gemstones and gods and goddesses, absolutely incredible, awesome experiences that often seem to have no connection with what one has learned in life thus far. Like it comes from, I don't know if it's our DNA or the spiritual world, whatever that is, but it's kind of empirical validation of what Carl Jung called the collective unconscious.
Because you're saying that you seem to be having these images of things that you may not have had any exposure to in your life. And so the question is, where do they come from? How do you have access to them?
Right. Well, I think they're simply there to be found within all of us.
Now, you make a distinction between these archetypal experiences that you've just been describing
right.
and an even deeper state, what you would call mystical experiences.
Right. Then there's this state beyond visionary imagery that we call mystical consciousness that is characterized by a sense of unity and profound intuitive knowledge. the everyday self just merging with something infinitely larger and more profound. We're finding in research that when that experience happens, there's often significant behavioral changes afterwards, finding it easier to be free of addictions or losing a fear of death and living more fully if you're terminally ill.
Why do you think that's the case? I mean, why do these experiences have such a sort of life-altering impact?
Well, on one hand, when they're experienced, they feel more real than everyday awareness. There's a sense that within you there are resources of strength and courage and wisdom that, especially if you've been an alcoholic or narcotic addict, you thought were never there. And all of a sudden you feel, well, of course I can get control of my addiction, you know?
Do you see many parallels between psychedelic experiences and classic religious experiences as we read about in the sacred texts, whether we're talking about, you know, in Hindu texts or Christian texts?
Very definitely. I would go so far as to say I think phenomenologically they're identical. It's the same realm of experience. And perhaps when these experiences happen spontaneously, similar, if not identical, biochemical events are happening in our brains.
In other words, maybe you don't always need to take this substance to generate the experience.
Precisely. And there always have been people who access these profound states without any drugs. And that's why I called my book Sacred Knowledge. I wanted to focus on the intuitive knowledge, if you will, that accompanies these mystical states of awareness.
Bill Richards talking with Steve Paulson. He's a clinical psychologist at Johns Hopkins and author of Sacred Knowledge, Psychedelics and Religious Experiences.
It might be over soon.
So I'm curious, having heard all these interviews, what do you think about psychedelic drugs? You can share your thoughts with us on our Facebook page or send us email at ttbook.org. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tangakar, Doug Gordon, and Mark Rickers. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Joe Hartke is our technical director. I'm Ann Strangehamps. Until next time.
It might be over soon.
PRI, Public Radio International.